This narrator advises that the listener digest the following as entertainment. The showrunners behind it are neither six-figure filmmakers nor professional critics. They are casually critical.
Hello and welcome to Casually Critical, the podcast show starring two pals who love to talk about storytelling. I'm your host, Jimmy N.
And I'm Danny C., your co-host. So we're here in the auditory and entertainment department, and we're about to dive into Severance, which is a piece of content that we've been asked to evaluate. Just so you know, we're going to play it pretty squeaky clean, Lumen compliant, all the way up until our spoiler section, where things are going to get a bit more sensitive, and only those of you with authorized clearance can stay as we digest some of this heavier material. In all seriousness, though, you want to be careful with who you mess with in high school, because there might be a girl doesn't look the best, and then 10 years later down the line, she comes back in, and the whole room's like, what? Wow, you're pretty and successful. What happened to you? And that's Ben Stiller. I never thought much of him as an actor or a person. I'm sorry, Ben, if you're listening to this. I thought, well, okay, Night at the Museum was a movie and a trilogy. It happened.
Zoolander exists.
Still haven't seen it. Still don't really care to. Yep. But then James, or Jimmy here... James said, Daniel, why don't you check out A Secret Life of Walter Mitty? And I thought, well, I've heard bad reviews. I'm not really, maybe. And then James showed me the soundtrack, and I was like, let me in, please. Let me in now. Saw it and thought, well, that was pretty good. Surprisingly inspiring. Then Ben Stiller bursts in the freaking room along with this nobody, Dan Erickson, and they just completely... just, man, they're unstoppable. A lot of people are talking about this series, Severance. A lot of people are swooning about it, including some award shows. This has won several Emmys. It's been nominated for 46 awards, including several Emmys. I think over 12 they were nominated for. So this is nothing to ignore. And James and I have both had the privilege of walking into this series, not really knowing anything. I'm going to stop myself there. There's just so much I want to talk about. But James, you haven't really said much yet. Talk to me about Severance.
Daniel, I'm really scared to say a lot here. I kind of want to share the premise of the show. Do you think that that would be okay for our non-spoiler review? Or do you think it would be better if people just go in blind? Because I knew the premise whenever I saw it, and I loved it.
Got it.
You did not, correct?
I did not. No, I knew nothing going into this. I was told to not even read the descriptions of the episodes, nor the titles of the episodes. So I didn't. I was completely blind. I didn't see any teasers, didn't see any trailers, nothing.
All I knew was a short Wikipedia article just kind of describing the premise of the show.
Okay.
I saw a few images from the show, mostly just the title image that you would see on IMDb.
Sure.
But yeah, what do you think? I kind of don't.
I think describing the premise would only spoil the first episode.
Correct. So let's try to just briefly describe what it's about without giving the premise away.
Okay.
And then give our rating, and then we can go a little bit further before we get to the spoiler review.
How does that sound? This is a pre quote unquote no spoiler review. This is our innocent, completely no information, and then we'll dive a little bit into the premise, then we'll go full spoilers.
This is an ultimate pat on the back, really, for Severance. Whenever we give a blind review before the spoiler-free review,
yeah,
that means that this is something that I personally loved so much that I really would recommend it to anybody who can handle some narrative darkness, I would say. But the overview that I can give it right now is that it is a gripping, suspenseful, office mystery dramedy that has a lot of different elements from different media that existed probably in the last 20 years, maybe 30 years. There was an era of movies before 9/11, right before it, where everyone thought that the world was kind of at its best and nothing interesting was going to happen. And so you got movies like The Matrix, where office environments were shown in really bland and boring and monotonous ways. You get movies like, oh shoot, what's the movie about the neighbor girl across the street and her friend's father who falls in love with her?
American Beauty.
Yes, you get American Beauty, where the office life is so bland and boring, and this man is just looking for new things to bring him excitement. This show digs into that a lot. It digs into the office imagery. It digs into work-life balance. It digs into a lot of modern work talk in very tongue-in-cheek ways in some places, and also in very serious ways. This show has a lot to say about the way we work and the way that we operate in and outside of our office.
And going on that, James, it never feels ham-fisted, propagandic, kind of a stick it to the man, you know, corporation bad, workers good. You know, it's not that it's super nuanced, but the storytelling is just that good. It's that textured. Yeah. You don't really know what's coming next. And even when you know what's coming next, you don't know exactly what that thing is. And it's amazing. I agree with you, James. Could not recommend this enough. If you like thrillers, this is the next one for you. This has a lot of elements of 10 Cloverfield Lane, which, since we're not describing the premise yet, I'm going to abstain from that, from clarifying that further. I will say the first episode takes a lot of cues from Breaking Bad's pilot, which is widely considered to be one of, if not the greatest television show pilots of all time. And it has one of the strongest opening images that I've seen in a long time. Even stronger, I would say, than Kubo and the Two Strings, which is saying a lot.
Yeah, and opening images is a great thing to look at when comparing this show to Breaking Bad specifically, because we've talked about this before. Breaking Bad is great at asking the question, how did we get here? The Breaking Bad pilot is fantastic at doing that. And that is exactly what happens at the beginning of Severance, too.
Yeah. From the beginning, the first 3 seconds, I just leaned forward. I was like, what? And it kept me there. That is high praise.
Yes. This is a peak television pilot on par with Breaking Bad's pilot. And I would say it, for the most part, carries on with that level of suspense, that level of gripping mystery and intrigue throughout the entire first season. Apple TV Plus is where you can catch this thing. I got the 7-day free trial. You should go do that too right now. I will say it took quite a bit of effort. I had to download an iTunes app and get an iTunes account first before. So now Apple has their claws in me, but I don't care because it was totally worth it to watch this show.
Yeah. It was well worth it for me as well. I'm glad I did it. If you're not going into this super blind, James, I know that you knew the premise going in.
Yeah.
It's still worth checking out.
Absolutely.
I think the reason why I advocate for people going into things blind is just there's something special. And once you learn something, you can't unlearn it. So the less you know about this, I would say the more unique your first time is going to be. But if you still know things about it, just watch it. The way they execute things, even if you know the thing, it's nothing short of masterful. And this is a show well worth watching. So James, before we continue on into the specifics of the premise, our pre-spoiler light spoiler talk, let's go ahead and give this a rating.
I would give Severance a 5 out of 5.
Brick. I'm going to do the same thing.
This is a casually critical victory, Daniel. We did it.
Casually critical certified fresh 5 out of 5, unanimous. That's a heck of a note to end our segment on. We're not going to go into spoilers, just to be clear, but we are going to talk about the premise. So this will spoil the first episode, which again is still worth watching.
If you're still not quite hooked, then keep listening until we get to our spoiler portion. Yes. Because if you really need more convincing, Daniel and I are more than happy to do that.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the premise now, because we've warned everyone, and if you're still watching or listening, I would like to know how you're watching, but...
oh, gosh. There's cameras everywhere.
Maybe there's an animated waveform. I don't know. yeah, this is basically 10 Cloverfield Lane. It deals with, you know, this subterranean living space that these people are trying to get out of that have no idea what's going on in the outside world. There's primarily a male oppressor, although there are several oppressors that try and feed misinformation or try to keep the people happy and situated down. And yet, while I like 10 Cloverfield Lane as a movie, Severance fully shows the strengths that the TV show medium, the streaming medium, can bring, because while it's not as strong out of the gate, it's strong in a more subdued way, and it's far more textured. And as the show evolves, as the story evolves, that texture is far more known. And you feel that while they aren't flexing hard right out of the gate, they continue to flex and they continue to get stronger and stronger in their writing as it goes on. The green-eyed monster for me came out throughout this show as I was like, why can't I freaking write the way that these people can? I mean, man.
Yeah, definitely. It was very hard for me to stop watching. And whenever I did, Sarah and I watched this together and we could not stop thinking about it or talking about it. Dude. Sarah was like, I'm going downstairs to fold some laundry. Can you come down with me? I'm like, okay, I'll come with you. I can't be up here alone on this tiny first floor of our rental home.
Yeah.
So premise, Daniel, do you want to give a rundown of what Severance is about?
Sure, I'll try to. The basic concept of Severance is about this one company, Lumen, this big overarching conglomerate that has pioneered many technologies, but the first and foremost being severance, to sever someone. Basically, what it looks like is severing certain memories from others. So this creates essentially two personas, two completely different people. One is your innie. One is your outie, and those are kind of internal words used to describe the person that you are when you go to work. These memory switching capabilities are triggered spatially. So what this looks like is in the TV show, there's an elevator. And when I go to work, I, Daniel Carpenter, dressing up right now for work, I go to work, and then I go in the elevator down to work. And as soon as I do, all my memories of the outside world switch, and now all I remember is my work life. So what this looks like is the Daniel Carpenter that's outside of work, the Audi, basically all I remember is I go to work, as soon as I go down the elevator, I immediately, my memories kick back in, I go into the elevator, and then I leave work. That's all it looks like to me. I come to work, and then I immediately leave work. That's all it looks like. But my innie, the person who stays inside work, all he remembers is work, always. As soon as he gets in the elevator to clock out and leave, his next memory is him leaving the elevator for yet another day of work. And it's a premise that is intriguing, but if I were to tell the story with the same premise, I don't think I could do nearly as good of a job as they did. Because I go, huh, that's interesting. But then they keep feeding you little breadcrumbs along a trail that keep you intrigued, that keep you hooked, world-building things. James, you and I never shut up about world-building. You and I never shut up about character and world-building. And they just, they do it so well. And what I will say is, one of the biggest things about storytelling isn't just world-building, it's the control of information. What the audience knows versus what they don't know versus what they don't need to know. And this, I'm going to say it, is one of, if not the greatest examples I've ever found of controlling information and story. They do such a masterful job. And I started reading into their language a bit. Like, towards the end, there were things that they were keeping revealed. I'm like, oh, I don't know this about this character, so probably a big reveal. And I was right, but I completely had no idea what exactly that reveal was. All yep. I knew was there's probably a big reveal, and I was still blown away. So well done.
And it's not like sucker punches. Like, this information that comes is like, oh, of course, that makes sense.
Right.
Why didn't I think of that together? Yeah, it all fits very well together. And speaking of world building, by the way, this show gets the world building gold star.
Oh, yeah.
This world, which I believe is in Canada, off the kind of the eastern coast, if my hunch is correct, like very close to the United States border, this world, above ground and below ground, it follows a sort of structure where there is a hidden fantastical world that you see in a lot of fantasy movies. However, right. this world is a lot scarier, a lot more threatening, a lot more mysterious. And yet somehow the normal world is just as mysterious and just as threatening and just as scary.
Yeah.
There are equal amounts of moments of reprieve and fear and mystery in both worlds. The severed floor in Lumen and the non-severed upper world outside of the Lumen building.
Yeah. Yeah. This is really, really good. They exercise all the classic world building stuff and they just add more meaning to it. You know, the conversations characters talk about, the controversies and politics and news of the world, how this realistically would affect our modern day, this feels perfectly integrated. Now, I will say, James, one gripe I have about modern streaming services, especially Apple TV Pluses, the little I have seen, the humor is off to me. The humor, the pacing. I'm thinking of Mythic Quest, which is another Apple TV Plus. It's posed as a workplace. It's a workplace comedy, essentially. The humor feels a lot more.
Are they gamers?
No, they're game developers. Developers. They develop a game called Mythic Quest. It's a fantasy RPG. It's fictitious, obviously. But the point is, I feel with a lot of modern comedies, Apple TV Plus, but also maybe to a lesser degree Netflix, either it's overtly campy and politicky, or it's very heavy. There's a heaviness that's been permeating our media lately. And I don't know if it's COVID, I don't know if it's just the cynicism of the time, but I don't like it. It's still pervasive in Severance, but it works. It's like this show, it's like it was made for this show. That heaviness, that dreariness, even in the lighter hearted moments, it adds this fluidity between the worlds. James, you and I had some dissension in our Enchanted review talking about the two worlds, the fantastical and the boring and realistic. My objection to Enchanted was, I want to be in the fantasy world, but we're stuck in boring New York City with boring characters, and we have some far better ones, and they could have done a better job. In Severance, I don't know how they could have done a better job integrating the worlds together, because they both add something. We get clarity and an outside focus in the external world, and we get this, even though the characters are more naive in the smaller world, our genre shifts. We're no longer fighting the big bad on the outside. We're trying to explore what the heck we're doing here. And we have answers that are more readily available, but they feel so far away because the characters don't know a whole lot. And as they learn, we learn this weird but almost fantastical world downstairs.
Yeah.
And it's, man, it whets my appetite.
And it's the beauty of the premise, really. The concept of severance and dividing one's consciousness into a work persona and a real life persona, that has baked in questions. And like you said, there's really cool stuff about how severance affects the real world, and there's legislation. There's people talking about it on the news about whether it should be legal or not. There's protesters out on the streets spreading the word saying end severance. There's, there's senators vouching for it out there. There's all kinds of stuff going on in the upper world that is so logical and so sound to me. It pulls me right in and it makes me believe everything about this world. So whenever off the wall crazy stuff happens, it just freaks me out even more. Because my suspension of disbelief is not disrupted. It's just thrown off for a little bit, and I'm completely perturbed. But whenever you have characters that have one character that are divided in half, and they don't know what the other person is doing,
Yeah.
There's just some baked in questions that are really, really interesting. No matter where the show goes, there's baked in questions that already draw me in. Like,
right.
Why did they go through with this procedure? Like, is there a specific reason why they're escaping 8 hours of their day being in their own body? And as a result, we get to know not four main characters, but eight main characters throughout the show. And it's fascinating because really there's only four people, but there are eight characters, eight different personalities as a result. And that's just brilliant.
And I'll be honest with you, this storytelling is surprisingly economical. We've talked about scene economy a few times on our show, but I've been shocked at just how well paced this goes. Every scene has a purpose or a question, which adds to the purpose. There's never a point where I'm like, oh my gosh, stop showing the boring workplace. I want the good action. I'm always in the good action. I'm always where I need to be as a viewer of the story. I never for a moment feel like I'm missing out on a better scene happening elsewhere. And when I do, it's in the season finale where everything is high stakes, but I'm not going to touch on that here. The season finale is about 40 minutes long. And I have legitimately begun to question why the heck we needed a 2.5 hour long finale for Stranger Things season 4.
Oh, amen. I was comparing this to Stranger Things season 4, actually, with Sarah the other night. And it felt like Stranger Things was such a burden to watch. It was so long. It's great. It's good. The characters are fun. How many characters are we juggling again? 16. Oh my gosh. Can we please go back to Severance where there are four characters? And I felt like 40 minutes was just not enough time for the series finale.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of reasons for that that I want to dive into later. But I was so stressed out during that last episode because I was like, there's not enough time. We got to hurry. There's too many things we have to figure out right now. It's so frantic and I love it. And yet it flows. It flows so well.
James, I'm sick and tired of talking around the good stuff. So with two perfect 5 stars, let's just go into spoilers so we can talk about this more.
Let's do it. Want to join the conversation? Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Casually Critical Podcast to get the inside scoop on future episodes. Feel free to message us on either platform to join in the casual correspondence or provide feedback on the show. Now it's time to dive into our spoiler review.
Okay, James, so I've completely unsevered myself from anything holding me back from just talking about the show entirely. Please, again, this is worth repeating. If you haven't seen the show, this is your time to stop. We already gave a lot away about the first episode. I don't want to be the one that accidentally, inadvertently spoils the entire show for you. So, I know that James doesn't want to do that either. So please stop listening. So all that being said, James, I'm going to ask you the worst question you ever want to hear on an episode like this. What was your favorite moment? Or should I say, what do you think was one of the best storytelling moments for you?
In the last episode, the scene where Mark is walking away after dodging Mrs. Cobell for the third time, and he slips her name while walking away. She's like, are you really thinking about ending your job at Lumen? And he's like, yeah. I'll talk to you more later after I talk to Devin. And she says, all right. And he says, thanks, Mrs. Cobell. That's where I started screaming at the television. Because we've been waiting for this for so long, for this to not happen. We don't want Mrs. Cobell to know what's going on with Mark in his Audi or in his innie. And so whenever this happens, I couldn't not yell at the TV because it's so tragic. And it's so perfectly done. I believe it was the founder of Pixar. And forgive me for not thinking of his name.
Ed Catmull?
Off the top of my head. Yeah, Catmull. I think it was Catmull that said, heroes have to work 3 times harder to get wins. But any defeats can happen out of sheer mistake or fluke or weird coincidence. And the audience will totally allow it.
We had an exact conversation about this when you and I saw the first Toy Story movie together in theaters during the pandemic.
Because
the first Toy Story movie, there are no good coincidences. There are only bad ones. Like when Woody and Buzz are riding the go-kart trying to get to the truck, Woody lights a match to try and light Buzz's rocket, and the wind blows out the match. And yep. what I think you and I realized is audiences can forgive when random bad stuff happens, but they don't forgive when random good stuff happens and helps the heroes. So it's exactly right.
Yep. And that's I think that's just realistic, you know, yeah. about life in general. Like, we tend to linger on the bad coincidences. The good coincidences, we don't crop up to anything because it's like, oh, gosh, dang it. It's time. I deserve a break.
Yeah.
But that's probably my favorite. The thanks, Mrs. Cobell thing. Just flip my lid. What about you, Daniel?
My gosh. I'm going to boil it down to two moments. One,
oh, two.
Was,
okay.
One saved this show for me from a 4.5 out of five. And another one was just incredibly well done. The incredibly well done one really wasn't a moment. It was just the reveal of Mrs. Casey, the therapist, mm-hmm. as Mark's wife. James, I hate love triangles so much. The premise that was delivered to me at the finale of where this could go, in terms of Mark, ex Helly, ex Mrs. Casey, is good because it's understandable within the logic of the show.
Yeah.
Mark isn't intentionally doing this, and now that he knows what's going on, that's going to lead to some interesting things. I don't think they're going to emphasize it too much, but man, it makes sense. I'm not upset at it. In fact, I'm like, oh, interesting. It's a love triangle that I don't hate. I'm actually intrigued about.
And really, it's not a love triangle that's going to pop off immediately at the beginning of the season. You know,
right.
There's going to be a lot of investigating of the experimental floor, I'm guessing. And we'll talk about season two theories later. But
right.
It is something that I feel like there's going to be bigger fish to fry, you know, with this, with the way that this show goes. Romance is not the top priority here. The top priority yeah. is getting down to business and figuring out what's really going on.
Right. And
what was your second one?
My second one had to do with Dylan. And that was not the moment when he discovers he has a son, but the moments after. You see, Dylan was my least favorite character. Did not like Dylan at all.
Called that.
Very annoying. Just very rude and crude. And I thought, okay, so Helly has value in the story. Mark has value to the story. Irving has value to the story. Dylan has no value. And I frankly don't know why he needs to be there. And Irving bothered me a little bit, but they started fleshing him out right in the early mid part of the season. But Dylan, I was always like, what depth does he have? Now, looking back, I realize his rude and crudeness is very reminiscent of a coworker in the workplace. There's going to be those types of people. Mm-hmm. So props to them for realism. But we learn so much about him when he realizes what his outie's world is like.
Yeah,
he stops making lewd jokes at the next pretty woman that walks in. He realizes, I have a son. I want to know what his name is. And even at the very end, Mr. Milchick uses that as leverage, saying, you have two more sons. Do you want to know their names? But Dylan, my boy Dylan, stays loyal. And I just, gosh dang it. And there's so much I want to praise this movie on. I want to talk briefly about the obvious one, which is, first off, as I just mentioned with Dylan, this gives characters dignity. Male and female, gay and straight, minority race and majority race. We're not looking at these people through those attributes. We're looking at them through character. They're all so well done. Even the ones that we don't know much about, you know, even the therapist, Miss Casey,
yep.
even Bert in optics and, you know, all that. Like, it's even the characters that we don't know a lot about, we don't really need to. We know enough about them to serve a point in the story. And they all have weaknesses. They have stuff they don't know. No one feels hyper competent. Everyone feels grounded and realistic in this world that is grounded yet slightly absurd.
Even our villains, we get to see the cracks in yeah. our primary antagonists, whom are so good. They're so well done. Mrs. Cobell is someone I can't stand the sight of her.
I hate her.
She's like the Azula of this show. I hate to hate her. In the same way, Milchick is a good villain, but I love to hate Mr. Milchick.
Oh, Mr. Milchick's great.
He's an absolute unit. Watching him run down the hallway in the season finale was an absolute treat, and I'd been waiting for it for so long because I could tell he could book it. He is a fit man.
And here's the thing, Mr. Milchick, the guy who plays him, does such a great job at just being that corporate, condescending, just the embodiment of corporatese. The embodiment. One of my favorite scenes to hate, maybe this is a scene I want to rewatch for sheer sadistic enjoyment because I hate it because it's so good, is the moment where they're passing the ball and playing that game. It's so condescending, and it reveals so much about how little these characters have a life outside of work, and Helly knows it. She just doesn't know why she knows it. Oh my gosh. You could tell the actors were having such a ball, no pun intended, such a fun time with this movie, this series.
I couldn't agree more about Milchick. I think they nailed the hammer on the head, or nailed it over the head with Milchick. He reminds me of my supervisor when I worked at a charter school. He was very lip service-y, very smiles. Not one moment that I had with him where I had come back from surgery, and you had already actually left Texas at this point, Daniel.
Oh no!
But he opened the door and said, "Hi, Mr. Newton. How are you?" And I said, "Hi, Mr. Espinoza. I'm doing boom." And the door had already slammed and he had just left. He had already left. He just wanted to go in, make sure I was alive, and leave.
And there's a terror to that corporate smile on the face always, because when Dylan bites Mr. Milchick in the arm and Mr. Milchick comes back and gives him the award for the waffle party and is super smiley, there's a danger behind it. And it's like terrifying.
The strongest incisors in MDR, big smile on.
And it's
stained
like
my turtleneck sweater, you little piece of garbage.
It's like, ha ha ha. Oh.
Have an egg. That's another thing I've got to highlight here. The subdued level of darkness in this show.
Yeah.
There's one element of darkness that I could not handle, and that was Helly's suicide attempt.
Right.
That was the one part where I was like, can I keep watching this show? I'm not sure. And it continued to move from a tragedy mystery into a more action mystery thriller from there. And that's where I really got to sink my teeth into the show.
Yeah. They're like, okay, we're not being subdued anymore. We're going to start moving things along.
Exactly. But like, even the crazy, like terrible consequences that do happen are incredibly realistic. Like the break room.
Yeah.
I swear to all things good, they base the break room off of Scientology.
Really?
This is exactly what they do in Scientology. Whenever someone commits a sin against the church, they bring them into a room, hook them up to a lie detector, and make them confess the sins that they never committed.
Ooh.
They have to lie to themselves. It's haunting how similar that is to that process within Scientology. It's crazy. And instead of, you know, all this darkness surrounding the break room, what is it? Yeah. What happens there? It's just a psychological beatdown, you know?
But here's the thing. Even like talking about consistency and dignity of characters, even Helly, when she goes through that, she talks, she apologizes over 1,000 times. She is so fatigued. She's so psychologically beaten down, but she still wants to get out. It hasn't stopped her. You know, that one thing is a bump in the road for her emotionally, but not in her character. She still wants to leave, and that remains her motivation. I'm shocked at how resilient some of these characters are. And you know what? They have opportunities to make these characters stupid, like a lot of movies and TV shows tend to do, where in the finale, when they're all adjusting, you know, they could have easily played up, and by they, I mean the writers, they could have easily played up that fish out of water scenario of, Oh, I'm so weirded out. I feel so awkward. I don't know what to do. And then someone's like, "Are you okay?" And be like, but no, these characters are smart. They're confused. They're anxious. They're shocked, but they play into it. You know, Mark S, not Mark Scott, but Mark S. When Mark S is in Mark Scott's world and people are like, "Hey, you're going to talk later about this, right?" He's like, "Oh yeah, no, I'll get back to you on that." He's able to play into that. He's able to ride that wave and play it smart. And I find myself rooting for him. I see so much of these characters of like Michelle in 10 Cloverfield Lane, their resourcefulness, the fact that they're never giving up and trying to find their goal. The evil is relentless, but so are the characters. And the characters, every time they get pushed down, they just stand back up. They go, okay, we tried overtly making an alliance with another department. We got shut down hard. Now we've got this key card that my Audi has put into my pocket. So now we're going to play the long game. We're going to change tactics up a little bit, but we're not going to stop. And it's not even, this is the part where the good guys win. I thought early on the arc of this would be, okay, yeah, Mark's going to get unsevered. That's clearly where the direction it's going.
Yeah, nope. Same.
No, and I realized, oh my gosh, that makes so much sense. If I was Mark, I wouldn't want to make such a massive life choice, but he's starting to unsever himself from the company emotionally first before he ever goes through that procedure, or may never. It's, gosh.
And it makes sense because these characters are smart. Mark saw his friend die because of his reintegration process, so of course he's going to be cautious about doing that. Yeah. And there's not enough time. There's too many other things he needs to figure out first. Yeah. Whenever the characters and the audience needs a win, they give us a win. Yeah. But there's always something else that needs to be overcome in this show. Even in the moments of reprieve, there's still things looming overhead. Looming overhead.
Ha! Well done. This, the finale ended. First off, I hate the fact that they ended on a cliffhanger, but I love it. Yeah. Let me talk first as Daniel, personally speaking. Give me the answers. Give me them now. Please. Tell me how this is going to affect the characters going forward. Okay. Now let me talk not personally, but as a story analyst looking at the story from the 10 millimeter view. Well done. I got so much resolution and so much satisfaction, so much catharsis from the fact that some characters now know things, like the fact that Mrs. Cobell was actually Mark's neighbor and was watching over their baby, and now Mark's sister knows that.
Yeah.
Oh,
the catharsis. Relief. That's a good word. There's so much catharsis in that episode.
Yeah. And there's so much relief. And at the same time, while they resolve so much, there's so many voids that I just need them to fill in. Like, how the heck does this affect their characters going forward? The fact that Helly R, we never learned anything about Helly's character. We didn't know anything about who she was. And I thought, oh my gosh, okay, that's got to be something important. She's a freaking...
Egan.
She's a freaking Egan. She is the heir, it looks like, to the throne. And the fact, the sheer irony of the fact that her innie is so rebellious and anti-systemic, and her Audi is so pro-Lumen, it's just so rich. And the fact that, again, scene economy, story economy, every character has weight to this. Even Irving, his character, it looks like just, we don't know his character, we know the least about, and yet they use the visuals they show, don't tell, to make us believe, okay, he's a veteran. He's been in the service. He comes from a family of veterans. He clearly has objections to Lumen. He's been charting out all the people that have been severed before. Maybe he was severed. Maybe his father was severed. He's trying to figure that out. We know all of this based on the set, the props, the camera work, the storytelling. It never stops. There's always value in every character. Where did these storytellers come from?
I don't know. Who the heck is Dan Erickson? So Dan Erickson, for those of you who don't know, he's the creator and one of the writers on the show. He pitched it to a couple different places, and eventually Ben Stiller's production company picked it up. And that's why Ben Stiller gets to direct, I believe, 6 of the 9 episodes.
He directs a lot of them.
Yeah.
And so her name, there's a lot of different writers for each episode. But the one that is a staff writer, I'm not sure what that is, but I feel like she oversees the quality control of all of them. I'm going to butcher your name, but I want to try because you deserve all this credit. Anna Uyang Mwench, I believe. I could be wrong. I could be saying that wrong. I'm so sorry, Anna or Anna. But gosh dang it. I tried looking up her IMDb profile. I tried looking up Dan Erickson's profile. The only things they have are severance. Holy cow.
They just came out of nowhere.
Yeah, Dan Erickson apparently wrote the first episode for Severance and pitched it in 2016, had it up on a website, and Ben Stiller chose it. The relationship that executives and producers and directors have in TV and streaming is different than what they have in film. In film, the director is the primary vision caster. he or she is the one that carries the creative vision from concept to production to coaching the actors to development and editing. In TV, it's the opposite. It's the executive producer that primarily does it, the showrunner, as they're commonly called. Dan Erickson is the showrunner. It says created by, so he's the showrunner. Ben Stiller, by him adopting it, letting Dan Erickson handle all the showrunning, Ben Stiller is an actor. He has a lot of experience as an actor. So for him to direct, for him to, yeah, produce, but also get in there and coach and guide the actors, masterful move, I think.
Yes.
Letting Ben Stiller play to his strengths. And more importantly, I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm assuming so. Ben, the fact that you let Dan play to his, it works.
Yeah.
It just works.
Just letting him hold his baby, you know?
Yeah.
Just letting him hold his baby, raise it, take it to elementary school. Maybe homeschooling. I don't know, whatever your thing is. And just nurturing that child. Thank you so much for doing that, Ben Stiller, and not turning this into something completely right. outside of the director's vision, because it feels so authentic and fresh as yeah. a result.
I want to look more seriously into Ben Stiller's company, because between Walter Mitty and this one, it's clear that the vibe I get of Ben Stiller is he doesn't walk onto a set saying, oh, I'm a big celebrity. I was in Night at the Museum with Robin Williams. Treat me like a god, and also I can do no wrong. It seems very much that Ben Stiller is intentional not about making a quick buck, but about making good art, making grounded art that communicates big ideas in grounded and surprisingly subdued ways. And I'm starting to be a fan. I might be a cult follower now of Ben Stiller. I'll need to look more into his work, but I think he's proving himself. I think he's a good actor. He has an impressive filmography. He's really proving himself as an exec and as a producer here.
Yes.
Well done. And also, I have to mention this in our casual correspondence episode. James, you mentioned that you'd want Adam Scott to play you in a movie. It's so good to get to have him have more time in the spotlight as the leading man, because so much of his acting is coming out now, more than I've ever seen it before.
Yeah, he's so good. And oh my gosh, they do such a good job of making him this ugly, puffy, sad man in the very first 5 minutes of this show. And it breaks me to see him in that condition.
Yeah.
But then whenever he walks into the Lumen building, puts his stuff away, goes down the elevator, and won't stop looking at that camera as he walks down this labyrinth of hallways, finds a tissue in his pocket, throws it away, all this freaking showing and none of this freaking telling. It's genius. And I wanted to trace back actually what we were saying about Irving. We know very little about Irving. Here's another great example of show don't tell in the show.
Do it.
He's drinking coffee. He's painting the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
He never said anything about it, but we see black paint at different parts throughout the show.
Yes.
Coming down from the ceilings. And it's like, huh, what's this black paint about? Somehow his Audi is trying to communicate with his innie. He's trying to make him fall asleep at the workplace by staying awake. We only know that because he's drinking coffee. There's nothing. He literally says two lines, I'm pretty sure. He says two lines in the season finale. One of them, the name of his dog. The other one is probably just Bert, yelling Bert at the door. I'm pretty sure those are the only things he says. But you're absolutely right. Everything that they show about him, we learn organically, and it feels so good, and it makes the audience feel so smart. There's too many shows now where the viewers, and the movies too, where the viewers just feel like total idiots for not seeing things coming, because everything gets explained to us.
I did not pick up on some of those nuances of Irving. That is freaking awesome.
I know.
A lot of shows tend to do this now where they say, okay, big finale's coming up. We got to add another big twist, some spice to it. This finale, which I will remind you, is only 40 minutes long.
It's not 5 hours. It's 40 minutes.
Here's what they do in the season finale. They literally just say, okay, we've set up all the pieces. We set up this is a weird metaphor, but it works. We set up the Hot Wheels track. We have the car. Now we just got to let the car go. That's literally it. And they do. And then at the right moment, the perfect moment, they say, okay, we're done. They just drop the mic and you go, what? this show knows what it's about. It's about the characters that inhabit this world. It's not about the world that have these characters in it. It's about the characters. The characters have just made some massive moves. But what we really want to know is the outies, the other characters, the other four characters, as you mentioned, James, how are their lives affected? They know that that's what we want, and they stop it. One thing I want to go back to, pivoting from the finale to the opening, they do the same thing. And this is so hard to do, is anticipating your audience as a storyteller. First shot is Helly, unconscious, in a conference room, by herself, and we hear this disembodied voice on the speaker. We have no idea what's going on. We want to know what this organization is. We want to know what the heck's happened to her. And here's the thing. The storytellers say, okay, we're counting on, and I'm going to try and describe this because I feel it's important I describe it right, but it's hard for me to. They know that those questions are looming large in your mind, but they don't ever feel the need to rush and address them. They're counting on those questions in your mind being so powerful enough that they keep you engaged for the long time until they start paying off those questions to you. We cut all the way back to say, okay, now let's introduce Mark's character, Adam Scott's character. Let's see Mark. He's a regular guy.
Let's look at this inflated balloon of a man sitting in his car, clearly
he's
hungover.
He's not an attractive celebrity who's looking handsome and, oh, life's just hard. No, he's broken. Dude, something broke this guy. This guy's tormented. This guy's drinking so much alcohol, he should get a sponsorship. I mean, holy cow. Right? Eat that Billy Bazinga. Bean from Moneyball, eating all the food. We cut back to Mark. Why do we do that? I think it's because, number one, we're building up story and character, but number two, and the biggest one, the storytellers know that the only reason we're still watching this brand new character after just getting introduced to an opening image is because we have to have these questions answered. And that's the only thing that's keeping us engaged in this strong opening image. They have so much faith in their opening image that they're saying, okay, now we're just going to take a backseat for a little bit. Oh, now we're getting a payoff. Oh my gosh, this was a flashback, actually. Oh, we're seeing it from a different perspective. Oh, interesting. But I still don't know what's going on. Okay, now we're learning more information. Okay, now we're learning about the severance procedure when Holly R gets her orientation. Oh, that was a payoff. It just didn't happen in the way I thought. Interesting. They're expositing, but it's in a brilliant contextual way, and we're listening to the exposition because we want to know. There's so much intelligent anticipation of your audience's wants and needs.
Yeah, I don't know if they tested this with anybody. I don't know what Dan Erickson, what pact he had to make with some sort of eldritch power to give him the ability to know exactly what my monkey brain want. My monkey brain want answer. My monkey brain want not unraveled in my stomach so that I feel good. That's not going to happen. And it's not going to happen ever. Not until season two comes out. And I don't know how many seasons they're planning.
At the Apple event, that just happened this month, towards the very end, there was a stinger of Severance. The woman who plays Holly, who plays Helly, was actually in the background, a brief cameo of one of their Apple events. They were announcing the Apple Watch or the AirPods. They were on a subway, a fake subway. She's in the background, apparently.
Oh, that's
so
fun.
They have confirmed season two is a go. Thank goodness, because we need it. I would have rioted against every industry known to mankind in the entertainment world if they had said, oh, we're canceling this, as Netflix probably would have.
It would have been a Firefly level outrage for me. Code Firefly. Yeah. Repeat, Code Firefly. But I'm going to say that since this show is getting a second season, and depending on how they execute that, it has the potential to rise above Firefly as one of my favorite television shows.
Really?
That's the reason I gave it a 5 out of 5. Firefly, I give a 4.5 out of 5 because it has a lot of good things going for it and personal preference as well. But Severance, it's just so well made, you can't ignore it. And people talk about Breaking Bad and how amazingly executed it is. I can't handle the way that that show is paced in contrast to this show. This pacing is very deliberate in Severance. Breaking Bad, I feel like, drags your face through the dirt to get you
darkness.
To the next payoff. And I just can't handle it.
Breaking Bad is a film essay in torturing your characters. They don't kill their darlings. They torture them slowly and painfully. They twist the knife they've already stabbed fully into their body. But with Severance, this is going into the world building as well. We get comedy and payoff and tonal diversity, not through blatant levity scenes or comedy characters. We get them through tonal shifts. So, oh man, the outside world is depressing. You know, Mark's sister, his brother-in-law, he's writing a spiritual hunky-dunky self-help book that's stupid. His sister's pregnant, and they're okay, I guess, as a couple. They're working through stuff. Mark's depressed, an alcoholic, can't keep a girl to save his life, even if it's the same girl over and over and over again. Oh, but now we're back in the funny corporate world. I don't know what's going on, but it's kind of funny how condescending and playful in some weird ways it is. And it's boring, but also there's comfort in it because we're not depressed, at least. And there's this tonal variance throughout of we're depressed. Oh, okay, well, we're switching it up. Okay, we're back in the corporate world. And it's just, oh, it's
but
great.
But even then, Daniel, in the outside world, we get these ridiculous caricatures of human beings. Like, one of the first scenes we get of the outside world, like, at length, is Mark attending a dinner with his sister and brother-in-law.
Yeah.
And they're having a non-food dinner party. And these people are just so over the top, and at the same time, I can point them towards people I know in real life. It's very eerie to me. To me, it just seems like it's not like the world is a beautiful place, like you said. It's not like the world is worth fighting for. It always comes down to the characters. And that's why I want to ask another question, kind of leading towards maybe some season two predictions. Do we need to know everything about this show for it to be perfect, for all the payoffs to be good?
There's a show similar to Severance. It wasn't a thriller, it was a horror, which you know all too well, is The Haunting of Hill House, season one. Now, I know that there have been seasons since then, and I'm told that season three is better. I don't know. This is all hearsay. I haven't seen any of them. Season one was so good because I didn't know anything. Then at the very end, I knew everything, and I wish I didn't.
Yeah.
That's why thrillers are really difficult. And even 10 Cloverfield Lane didn't perfectly stick the landing. It came close, but we knew too much. And the best thrillers I've found, I say hesitantly, the information that you learn raises more questions. The ending of this season, even if it got canceled, there's still some catharsis. We don't question the ending. We question the ramifications of it. That's why we want season two. We don't get to know, oh my gosh, does she finally get to say the thing? No, she said the thing. Helly said her thing. Irving almost said his thing. Mark definitely said a lot more things than I thought he was going to say.
Yeah.
So a lot was said. There's a lot of catharsis. And yet, while they resolve it blatantly, you realize, oh my gosh, this was never a show about doing things. This is the show about reacting to things. When Mr. Grainer gets killed, it's not necessarily his death that's shocking. It's more about the ramifications of his death for the Innies world. And that is a beautiful, beautiful seesaw that Dan Erickson and his writing team and Ben Stiller like to play on that seesaw and balance it out a lot. And it's just so well done. Like Harmony Cobell, my other least favorite character. I hate her. I wanted her gone. And the more we explored her character, the more I found myself realizing, oh, dear God, we're going to keep following this character.
Yep.
And then she gets fired. And I went, huh. So she's dead? They killed her off in the corporate way? No. Now she's a loose cannon.
Yep.
Now she's got
nothing to lose.
She's still loyal to Lumen. She's got that freakishly religious zeal for Keir. But holy cow, they didn't say, oh, she's just bad. It's like, well, she's bad in this way, but now she's bad in this way. And, you know, I'll be honest with you. I don't know where she's going. I don't like her, but I trust the writing team. I trust Dan and I trust Ben.
I do too. I think you're absolutely right. I think even if we don't get all the answers that we need, even at the very end of the show, I will still be very content as long as we get character-based resolutions. There's some things about the world that I'm totally okay with being left undone. Can we talk about the goat room? Can we talk about the weird corporate graphics that O&D was making? What are those about? Can we talk about the paintings? And can we talk about the numbers? You know, that's always there. What are the numbers there that they're sorting at macro data? And why are they sorting them?
Right.
We don't know. And at this point, I'm okay with not knowing. What I really want to know is what's the experimental floor all about? And how did they manage to smuggle Miss Casey slash her dead body there?
Yeah.
Do you want to start diving into the speculation, or do you have any other things?
I want to know personally, when Petey's talking about a place where no one ever escapes and it's eternal, talk to me about that, writers.
Yeah.
I want to know more about that hellish existence. And think about it. If they have such a thing, it's perfect. Even if a prisoner escapes, are they going to remember their time there? No. If they somehow slip through Lumen's fingers, they're not going to tell anyone because they're severed. It's perfect. I'm terrified. I love it.
As am I. I'm terrified and I love it. That is this show.
I don't know if I have a lot to say, James, in terms of speculation. Unlike Kung Fu Panda 4, which we pitched in our Kung Fu Panda 3 review, I don't really care to speculate. I just want to give the reins over to the writers, honestly, because I know that whatever they do, A, it's not going to be what I expect, and B, it's going to be well-written and with care. This is a great show. There are not many shows like this out there. They do so much, so well. I want to buy a script for the pilot of this so I can dissect it more, so I can figure out the pacing and the writing that they did behind the scenes. Well done. Well done.
Well, we have been Daniel and James, and you've been listening to our podcast, Casually Critical. And remember, our job is to taste free air. Your so-called boss may own the clock that taunts you from the wall, but my friends, the hour is yours.